Welcome to episode 61 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. Today's Big Web Show is brought to you by HappyCog Hosting. HappyCog Hosting is industrial-grade, optimized lamp stack hosting for high-traffic sites. Visit us at happycoghosting.com or call 855-COG-HOST to find out more about hosting done the HappyCog way. Today's guest is the incredible Coy Vinn. He's an art director, designer, with a traditional graphic design background. He's written an important book. He's been a design director at the New York Times. He co-founded a very important New York agency. He has got products out, including templates for Expression Engine and Mixel, a wonderful new fun product. And his dog's name is Mr. President, which
hi there.
You gotta love. Hi, Coy.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Pleasure. So you graduated high school in 1989, which
yeah, way back.
It's hard to believe that was a while ago.
Yeah.
So you knew you wanted to be a graphic designer all along. Is that correct? As a kid, you knew this?
So I didn't know that I wanted to be a graphic designer as a kid, but you know what I was interested in was art and drawing and painting, and that's what I thought I was going to do when I went to art school. And it wasn't until about halfway through that I realized that all the problems that I was interested in as a painter were really graphic design problems, and so I started focusing on that, and it eventually led me to the web and to doing web products, and here I am.
You painted?
Yes.
That's hard.
It's really hard, and I wasn't that good at it. But you know what's interesting is when I go back and look at my old paintings, they were very collage-like, and so I was always interested in this idea of combining, you know, an eclectic array of images into a single composition. That's what makes Mixel so great for us.
You know, it's interesting because I sucked at painting. it was impossible for me, but I. My best painting involved cat litter. I put cat litter into the painting, and my dad still hangs it on his wall. God bless him. I'm shamed every time I visit him, but he thinks it's great because he's a dad. So that's nice.
Yeah.
And I loved collage. That was definitely there's a connection between collage, lo-fi publishing, and the web, right?
Yeah, for sure. Actually, in school, I made a few sort of DIY comics. So lo-fi publishing was, you know, something I was interested in from the very beginning. You know, running comics off of copy machines and you know, having staple parties where I would just assemble them that way.
Nice. Did you sell anything as a kid?
Not really. I was not a natural entrepreneur as a kid. I think like a lot of designers, I really just wanted to focus on making work and the act of designing or painting or what have you. And I wanted to sort of lose the rest of the world around me. It wasn't until I was in my 20s I realized, you know, in order to do the work that I really wanted to do, I had to get better at that stuff.
Yeah. So help us understand the... I want to talk about Mixel. I want to spend the bulk of the time talking about Mixel, but I want to really get your background because you've done so much interesting stuff. And one of the things people like about this show is it helps them identify and go, wow, I could have a career like that. Or,
right.
Okay, so here you are. You've just graduated college. It's 1993. If I remember correctly, the economy's not great in 1993.
Right.
And you must have done some apprentice work before you started Behavior
Yeah.
Who did you work for?
So when I first came out of college, well, I had an internship at a design studio in Orange County, California, where my parents lived. And the first few weeks at that design studio, I was actually cutting rubylith or amberlith, if you remember that. That was the old way to make mechanicals and graphic design. And I tried that for a couple of weeks, and then the owner of the design studio said to me, you know, I can't really use these because you're no good at cutting this stuff. If you want to work after hours to do it in Illustrator, you know, I can use them, but I can't pay you double the wage to do the same task two different ways. And I said, sure, I'll try it. And I'd already been playing with Illustrator. It was, you know, much more natural for me to do it that way. And so it really shows that, you know, without without the Mac, without, you know, WYSIWYG software, I probably never would have gotten into graphic design because the physical process of making it was so difficult for me.
I have a similar story of getting fired by a guy because I wasn't good at doing shit. So what happened then? How did you move it into the web?
So, like I said, you know, I fell in love with the Mac and with computers at the same time as I did with design. And when the commercial web started becoming like a real thing in the mid-90s, it was a pretty natural transition for me. I was working at a print design studio, but I was really excited about what was going on the web, and I would spend, you know, nights and weekends. You know, when you're single and in your 20s, you can do this. You know, I put together my first website and like hand-coded, you know, all the HTML, and I just really learned all the mechanics of doing that. And I still thought that I liked doing traditional print graphic design, but more and more I just got, you know, immersed in the web. And I was actually living in Washington, D.C. for a few years. And so I moved to New York in the late 90s. And I'd always wanted to move to New York. And I didn't have a job when I moved here. But when I pounded the pavement and finally got a job offer, it was for a job that was 100% web stuff. And that's at the point where I left all of the print stuff behind. And it was at a big web agency that's no longer active. It was called Rare Medium.
Sure.
And, you know, I did web stuff for clients in New York City from there on out.
Is that where you found your partners?
Yep, that's right. My former partners and I met at Rare Medium. And like a lot of agencies during that big dot-com bubble, the company flew really high and then it fell really quickly. And so at the end, early 2001, we started seeing the writing on the wall and realized that we'd had to come up with a plan for employment after the company would have, you know, inevitably fall apart. And we started talking about it, and then, you know, the horrible, you know, events of September 11th happened. And after that, basically no one was hiring, nothing was happening. We were lucky enough to have a few leads for client work, and so we decided to form a studio, and that was in December of 2001, so, you know, almost exactly 10 years ago.
Congratulations on that, on the anniversary. How did you pick the name Behavior, and what were the complementary skills that y'all had?
So Behavior was, you know, it was like naming a rock band. We had lists and email threads, you know, dozens of replies long about the name, and we would just send these, you know, these words back and forth to see if there's anything that stuck. And I came up with Behavior, and what I liked about it was the idea that, you know, our design was not really like traditional graphic design, in that it wasn't just about the presentation. It was really about the way the designs behaved and responded to users. And it was, you know, very, you know, early, or I guess I should say primitive, you know, thinking about, you know, total user experience and user experience design. And so we thought of ourselves as really designing behaviors rather than just designing presentations.
The name totally conveys that. It's an absolutely brilliant name.
And, thank you.
And you were the, I believe you were the design lead, right? I mean, your partners were more UX people or more business people?
No, that's I think there was a lot of you know, visual design talent there, and a lot of UX talent shared amongst all five partners. So I think we all every project we took on, I think regardless of what our skills were, some of us were IAs, some of us were visual design people, some of us were technologists. Everybody sort of took on responsibility for the total UX of whatever project or whatever client they worked with.
Did you find it difficult hiring employees, sort of bringing in people who weren't at the partner level?
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the many lessons I learned from running that services business. This is the idea that balancing the demands of clients and the demands of staff is just a really, really tricky, thing to pull off. We tried hiring people, we tried, you know, bringing people on contract, and, you know, it was, I think, largely successful, but just there was enough times where it didn't work out great that it just, you know, taught me, you really have to be great at resourcing people. You really have to have a great network of people who really want to work with you in order to make the business succeed.
And during all this time, you were also blogging, which you started doing fairly early. Subtraction.com is your website. It's now at version 7.1. When did you start and what got you into it?
So I think in 99, I started writing essays on Subtraction.com, but not using any publishing software. I was traveling a lot and thinking a lot about, you know, design and the world at large. And so I had this urge to do it, but I didn't really know anything about how to create my own publishing system. And then one of my former partners from Behavior, actually, Chris Fahey, he's still a good friend of mine, he said, "Hey, have you seen this Blogger thing?" And I had a look at Blogger.com in its early form and found it really easy to hook it up and push its contents to my site. And I started doing blogging. I guess that must have been 2000. And I remember after about a year of doing that, I was really impressed that I had been doing it for a year. I thought for sure I was going to quit in the middle of that. And I think I realized at that point that I really enjoyed the self-publishing aspect of blogging and how it gave me an opportunity to basically create my own publication.
How I love that too. I've always loved that about the simplicity of publishing on the web. Right. How important is it to you in your mind for a designer to be able to write and present ideas to?
Incredibly important. I mean, that's one of the things that I've looked for in people that I've hired over and over again, is when they can express themselves clearly in written form, it shows me that they have a clarity of thought that can only help their ability to design and also to communicate the reasons behind their designs to others and to defend their ideas and their thinking. And that makes for a very powerful designer. And those are the kinds of people that I want to work with.
Right, because there's the kind of designer that can basically stand up to a tough client, not antagonize them, but can say, "Here's why."
Yeah.
And there's the kind of designer that can't. And if you can't, even if you're very talented, your work's going to get muddied.
Exactly. And I think the thing about being able to write is, writing is like a process of continually learning. And when you're articulating a rationale behind a design to a client, let's say you do it now and you fail, you're learning a lot about why that works and why it doesn't work. So the next time out that you do it, you're going to get a little bit better at it over and over. And so if you have good habits as a writer, you have good habits as a learner, I think. It's just, I think, an invaluable skill for designers.
Chris Fahey also blogs. Did all of you blog?
No, we didn't. It was Chris and myself primarily.
Was there tension in the company over you two being better known because of the activity?
There was tension over the blogs. I don't think there was tension over the notoriety. I don't think that bothered my other partners. My notoriety at the time was not particularly notable.
Sure.
I mean, it was minor. But you know, the thing about blogging is you have to be really frank and honest in what you're saying in order for people to pay attention to you. And I always tried to follow that, you know, that principle. And in a partnership, that can lead to strife. Understandably, I think it was, you know, very understandable that, you know, sometimes, you know, what you say is can rub people the wrong way.
Sure. If you have an internal argument and then basically that becomes a blog post.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you're trying to pick a fight with your colleague, but just
right. You
feel passionately about an idea, so you write it. Your partner doesn't get this opportunity to do that because they don't have a blog and they don't have writers. And I can see that being difficult. You left in 2000. One of the things we competed for at least one job, which you guys won, which was The Onion, which broke my heart.
I'm sorry.
Wanted to do that. I so wanted to, and I guess kept thinking, but we're funnier than them. But one thing that you were, there were many reasons why you won it, and you did great work for them. But one of the things you brought to The Onion was this very, you know, here they are comedy site, but you brought to them a very serious newspaper approach. Right? You've been interested, I mean, you're not the first designer to know about the grid or to use the grid in your in design work, but I think you were the first web designer to be very vocal about using it. You certainly popularized it, made a lot of designers who weren't classically trained aware of it, and you brought that to that project. You brought, and I think that helped. I think the grid helped make that website look serious as a newspaper, which helps the comedy, right? Because, you know, play it straight. I think it attracted the kind of publishing clients that that there are in New York, because it looks, you helped make the web look like a serious publishing platform when a lot of publishers didn't realize that's where everything was going and didn't realize that, you know, that it is, that's, that it's the future of publishing. So here's now it's the mid-2000s. The web is the future of publishing, but a lot of publishers aren't ready for that. And you guys develop a name for yourselves in part because you can make websites that look as good as newspapers or look like news. What got you into the grid and how did you start proselytizing about it?
Well, I you know, as I said, when I went to school, I studied drawing and painting, and it wasn't until late my junior year and my senior year that I was able to take design classes. And so it was kind of an ad hoc design education. And I got a little bit of exposure to the grid at that point, but I didn't really have deep schooling in it. And so I had sort of taught myself most of what I knew about the grid, but the attraction was that, you know, I always thought design was something that you know, you could do objectively. And I know that's not entirely true, but I felt like you could make a lot of decisions in design if you had sort of like a really concrete objective foundation. And to me, the grid gives you that and lets you make decisions in composition and layout and behavior in the total user experience that are almost no-brainers if you have a good foundation. You know, you just sort of follow where the grid leads you. And that's been an idea that's been very attractive to me for, you know, the entirety of my career. And like I said, you know, writing is a kind of learning, and I started writing about it because I was learning about it and sort of learning out loud. And I was very lucky that people, you know, started paying attention to it and started giving me a little bit of credit for helping to proselytize it, as you say. So it was kind of accidental. I mean, I never set out to become the grid guy by any means.
And I'm sure you. In fact, that's another good lead into Mixel, because that's the anti-grid product. But before we get there, I'm just teasing now. But before we get there, I think it's the opposite of fine art, right? With fine art, you're expressing your genius and you're waiting for the muse to strike, and you can't. I mean, not necessarily. We had Mike Montero on the show last week, and he uses a very strict discipline to create his art. He uses his very limited means to create his art, so. It's also like that too. If you say, all right, I've got this grid, so therefore I don't have to worry, where do I put this thing? It's basically, there are three places I might put it, and then I can look at it in the hierarchy and go, well, if it's of this importance, then this place makes the most sense.
Exactly.
It's like you're solving a puzzle.
The constraints are they help you and they also inspire you, I think.
So around this time that you're doing all this publishing and speaking, you're also running AIGA or the local chapter. Was it the local chapter of AIGA, the New York chapter?
I was never running it. I was on the board. And you know, learned a lot from that experience.
What made you participate in the AIGA?
Well, you know, when I first encountered design, it was all about graphic design, and I developed this canon of heroes who were all, you know, print designers, and they all came out of AIGA. AIGA is an integral part of that tradition. So when I, you know, was lucky enough to be invited to join, I said, yes, of course. I'd be honored to do what I can to help this organization. And it was a great experience for me.
How did the New York Times find you? Did they find you through AIGA, through behavior, your writings?
I had a friend of mine, David Womack, was friendly with Steve Heller, who's art director at the New York Times. And Steve said, we're trying to find this design director for NewYorkTimes.com. And David said, oh, you should talk to my friend Coy, who's been doing, you know, a lot of work that you might find relevant. And so he put us in touch. And before I ever talked to him, I just sort of assumed that it must have been, you know, an opening for a design director, not the design director position. Right. And we started talking. It quickly became apparent that it was, you know, the role was to lead the digital design team at nytimes.com. And we had a number of conversations, and this was late 2005, and we, you know, started getting really serious in I think November, and by December I knew that I was going to leave, and I wrapped up my partnership. You know, my former partners are still running behavior, but I exited at the end of 2005.
How did you reach that decision to leave? I would find it difficult to leave a company I helped create.
Yeah.
What made the New York Times inevitable for you?
It was a number of things. I mean, first and foremost, just the opportunity to work at the Times at that level, that strategic level, was just, you know, something I wouldn't have been able to turn down based on where I was in my life at the time. I really wanted to give it a try. I felt really deeply passionate about the brand. I felt like I could really do some good there. And so that was the number one thing for me. But you're right. I mean, I had spent 4 years building behavior with my partners at the time, and I had invested a huge amount of, you know, my energy and my soul and my youth into the company, and it was very hard to come to the decision to leave. But I was also ready to leave. I think, you know, and I've written about this, but one of the unfortunate side effects of us, you know, coming together at the end of 2001 was we didn't, or at least for my part, I didn't really think about, you know, can I work with these people long term? I mean, they're really talented, smart people, but, you know, over the 4 years I was there, it sort of became apparent to me that we had, you know, very different visions for how the business should grow. And I got to a point where I was like, you know what, they need to take the business in one way, and I want to take it in a different way. And I had this great opportunity at the Times. I think it makes sense for me to, you know, to leave and let them do what they want to do with it, and for me to go my own path. It wasn't an easy decision, but at the same time, you know, all these factors came together and it made a lot of sense.
Where would you have taken it that was different?
I would have, I think at the time that I left, the company was maybe around 20 people, a little bit less than 20 people, you know, if you combine all the contractors and the full-time people together. And I would have scaled back and gone much smaller and focused on winning fewer clients and establishing a reputation as a really, really premium, you know, studio, and doing very selective projects, and really, really almost focusing narrowly. Now, I'm not saying that would have succeeded, but I wasn't comfortable with the direction at the time, which seemed to emphasize, you know, growing in headcount, growing in the client roster, covering a lot of different, you know, industries and client types. I really wanted to work on just the stuff that I thought I could really make a difference on.
That's the essential problem for anyone who starts a design business that begins to have success.
Yes.
How big do I want to grow and change? I mean, I'm going to change anyway. Do I want to get really big and make a lot of money, or do I want to get really special and get a lot of, make a difference and get a lot of attention or a lot of,
yeah.
That's tough. So let's talk about what you're doing now. You left the Times in
July 2010.
And you have a daughter during this time.
Yes.
And the next thing you do is what? Did you say, what am I going to do now? When you left the Times, did you know where you were, what you were going to do?
Well, I think when my daughter came along, I realized that, and I think I'm sure you must have realized this too, that every day kid gets more expensive than the day before.
Sure.
And that was a wake-up call for me, because I was making a very good salary at the time, so I was already starting to feel that I wasn't really happy doing what I was doing, and I wasn't going to be happy doing that long term. But I also recognized that that, you know, the salary was going to keep me there, and that if I didn't make a break now, that I was never going to be able to make a break. And I really wanted to take on some risk, because I felt like my tolerance for risk was diminishing monthly. So I resolved at the beginning of the year to try and leave by the middle of the year, and I just made it in late July. And I knew that I wanted to do a product, because I'd gotten a really intoxicating taste of product development while at the Times. Working on a product day in and day out and evolving it was very different from client work in my experience, in that, you know, I got to stick with some of these products over the course of years and got to work with these people over the course of years and build relationships and you know, plan out long-term strategies and actually make them happen. And that, you know, in my experience, that was rare, working with clients.
Right.
And I wanted more of that. And I also, having come from the Times, I wanted to go into a much smaller environment. So when I left in July of 2010, I knew that I wanted to do a startup of some kind. I wanted to join somebody else's startup as a founder or an early employee, or I wanted to create a startup of my own. And so from July, August, September, I spent a lot of time talking to a lot of different people about what I could do next. All the while I was nursing this idea that eventually became Mixel, and you know,
Where did you come up with it? I mean, for people who haven't used it yet, it's a fairly addictive collage game.
Yeah.
And it's a social collage game, right? Because you can basically remix, so it's got remix other people's stuff. So basically, you take images out of your own iPad library or from the internet, wherever you may get the images, and you can cut them, slice them, dice them, duplicate them, rotate them.
Exactly.
Do anything you can do in Photoshop with your fingers. It seems like most of the people who are really fierce users have a sardonic sense of humor, and they're using it to make statements that maybe you couldn't make it with words, or if you did, you know, they would be too troubling if you made it with words, right?
Yeah.
So, but, where did this idea come from?
So, you know, I mentioned at school my paintings were very collage-like, so there was a seed of that there all along.
Right.
But really, you know, when the iPad came out in early 2010, I really fell in love with it, and I really recognized it as transformative in many different ways. And one of the things that interested me the most was this idea that, you know, they were selling these by the millions, right? People were buying them to read email and read books and watch videos. But at the same time, you know, people were bringing this kind of ideal digital art making tool into their homes. And almost, you know, it's almost like you had this whole, you know, art making kit sneak in the side door.
Right.
And it is And this is happening on a scale that, you know, that a Wacom tablet or other digital art tools had never been able to achieve before. And I thought that was really, really interesting. And I looked at all the art apps in the App Store, and I realized that they were really powerful, but none of them were truly converting people who weren't artists into artists. So the people who were buying these iPads, you know, even early 2010, they were not artists, by and large. They were media people and people who, you know, like technology or wanted to read books or wanted to watch movies. And I said that there was a real opportunity here to turn people who were not artists into artists if we can come up with the right software to do it. And it hit me right away that the way to make that happen was to make art social in a way that it had never been before. And so I actually started out.
Where did that come from? Were you, I mean, literally, were you, you know, it's like the story of the peanut butter and the jelly trucks colliding. What two things? Because, I mean, I love collage, I love art, I love social media. I would never have put them together.
Yeah,
how did you do it? What was the inspiration?
Well, I knew social was the answer because, I mean, for, you know, 5 or 10 years now, I've recognized that social is going to transform everything. Like, I often say, like, everything that can be social will be, whether it's, you know, banking or I don't know, exercise or making art.
Right.
Everything is going to be transformed by social media, social software.
It's like we're back in a little village, right? We've evolved as village creatures. We've been that way, and it's only the last 100 years where we've lived in cities or lived in. No, we've lived in cities for maybe 500 years, but it's only the last 100 years or so where they've been like gigantic cities where we basically have mass media fed to us.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right.
So here, this is kind of like punk rock, too. It's like punk rock was your neighbor down the street is going to be a rock star. Your rock star. Your community's rock star.
Very much.
And this is the same thing for art, fine art.
So, I mean, there's this big idea that social is going to change everything, but I actually saw it make that change in a really material way with photography. And if you were to go back into time 2 decades and say to somebody, you know, in 2011, 2012, walk down Broadway, Manhattan, and everybody's going to be carrying around a camera and everybody's going to be taking, you know, the equivalent of a roll of film a week, if not a day.
Right.
You know, this person from 1991 would have just said, you're crazy. But it happened, and partly it was because of the hardware. That's obvious and true, but also a huge part of that was photography got social, and now it's, you know, anybody can take a photo. It's accepted.
Right. There's Flickr, and then there was Instagram, and
Mixel
feels more like Instagram.
Yeah, well, we really are emphasizing the conversational nature and communicating I guess expressionistically, if that's a word, rather than in a sort of documentary form, which I think we saw a lot of with Flickr and other photo sharing networks. It's really just sort of about these things that you know, standard straight-ahead photo can't communicate. Hugely impressed with Instagram. I think that's one of the many things they did right was to sort of open up this door, this new kind of visual self-expression, and make it incredibly easy for people to take part in.
Right. It's interesting, too, because Mixel's kind of blurs the line between gaming and art.
Yeah, there's a lightweight, what we think of as a lightweight gaming dynamic or some dynamics in Mixel for sure. You can remix things. Right? When you create a Mixel, people can remix you, and so you sort of see what their response is. And there's a very game-like thing going on there, where it's almost like people are trying to one-up each other or amuse each other within the remixes. And then we have this ability to, well, you can like Mixels
or love
like collages throughout.
You can like or love.
Right.
What's going on with that? Where did you come up with that?
So, you know, when we were experimenting with it early on, we saw that people were liking collages. It's like favoriting on Flickr or liking on Facebook. You can say, yep, I like this, I like that. But we knew we were going to create an experience that was very light on text, had very little text in it. And we realized that there wasn't really a way to really say, hey, I didn't just like this. I really, really liked it. I loved it, in fact. And we said, well, why don't we create another level of light called love? And we said, well, what would be the difference then between like and love? And the way to create values in the hearts that you distribute would be to make them scarce. So right now, once a week, you get 5 new hearts to distribute, 5 new loves to distribute. And you can use them throughout the week. And if you don't use them, they're gone. And the following Sunday night, they're refreshed, and you have 5 more. So that when you say, I really love this, the person who made it can really know that you know, this mattered to the person on the other side.
It's currency. Like in e-music, you have a certain amount of credits, or now dollars. But
yeah,
if you don't spend them, they're gone.
Yeah, exactly.
How for Food Spotting also, I think, tried having although I think they've discarded it now. They had 2 levels of liking. It was or like,
mm-hmm.
And now they're struggling at Food Spotting with liking versus loving versus recommending. Sharing this meal because I love it is different than I hardly recommend this meal because it's healthy or because, you know, it's a good value for the price or something. It's 2 different things. That's, you could probably spend hours just figuring out that kind of stuff, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And
how do you know if it's succeeding? How do you know if like and love are working or?
Well, I mean, part of the answer is analytics, like breaking down the numbers and seeing how many people are, you know, actually using their likes, and if those people who are distributing loves are engaging more than others, and people receiving them are engaging more than others. So then we're in the process of doing that now and really trying to understand what's going on in the network. I mean, it's very early on, but we're encouraged by what we see. Also, you know, just you know, keeping track on the network or on the community and seeing how people are responding to it, and they have responded really well to the like/love dynamic, and are talking about it. You know, at late in the week, we're finding people saying in comments, "Oh, I would have loved this if I had any more, you know, loves to distribute, but I have to wait till next week," and stuff like that. So,
nice.
You know, anecdotally, you know, we're finding people are enjoying it.
How do you keep? Anytime you have images, right, people can grab images and reuse them. There's a couple of risks, obviously. One is a copyright risk, and the other is that kids could be using it and be exposed to imagery they shouldn't be exposed to. How do you?
Yeah.
I know you don't have a big. It doesn't. There's not like karma points or policing that I can see. So how do you keep? For instance, how do you keep kids from accessing the tool?
So there are a couple of things. First, we comply with the DMCA. So if you're a copyright owner and you see something on the site that you object to or you just don't want to use at all, you can file a complaint, a DMCA complaint, and we'll take down the offending content. We haven't seen any complaints yet,
that, right?
But you know, we're realistic. We know that you know, if we're successful, then that kind of thing will come, and we'll, you know, cross that bridge when we get to it more comprehensively.
Now everything is kind of it's a walled garden, right? In that, like, if I use Flickr, even if I'm using Flickr's app, is kind of an afterthought. Flickr's
mm-hmm.
website is really what Flickr's about. Instagram's really about an app. I might see your photo and go, that's great. But if you link to it on Twitter and I see it on the website, I can't favorite it. I can't click your Instagram, your profile, and visit it in Instagram. I can't see what other pictures you've done. And so far, which, you know, is arguably a problem with Instagram.
Yeah.
It's certainly a decision. Your Mixel is the same in that, you know, I Mike Montero does this crazy thing with Al Jolson's head and links to it from Twitter, and I go, wow, that's amazing. I can save it as an image, but if I want to, but that's I can't interact with Mixel from the web. I have to go into the app and find it again. Is that a deliberate decision to help keep it safe and secluded, or is that just something you haven't gotten to yet and you plan to do more with the web? What's the deal there?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, we're a two-person company. It's my co-founder, Scott Osler, and myself. So there's really a very limited amount of stuff that we've been able to do so far. And we have ambitions to do a lot more, and we'll actually be growing our staff in the new year. So we will be able to do a lot more. When we sat down to figure out what we were going to build on the web, this summer and going into the fall, it just made sense to say, you know, we'll have a limited web presence. We're going to focus on getting the app experience right first and go back and reassess the web later. And I think you will see us build some more robust thing, interactions on the website, on mixel.cc. The limits that you see.
I didn't mean to blindside you about this. I assumed it was something that you're aware of. And
oh no, I don't. Yeah, okay. I think it's a totally fair question.
Okay,
I think
two people is pretty impressive.
Thank you.
It was a much bigger group. But how are you? Are you hosting this in the cloud?
Yeah, Every image, every collage is stored in its original form on our servers in the cloud. We use Amazon to do that. So,
how expensive is this?
It's actually not too expensive right now. It hasn't been a major expenditure for us. But as we scale up, we're going to have to think about how the economics change for sure.
Do you have? So right now, I don't remember whether I paid for it or not, which shows that if I did pay for it, it wasn't much, maybe like $1.99 or $3.99 or something. Are you going to have in-app selling of filters or easier selection tools or something like that? Or
yeah, well, the app is free,
right?
So anybody can download it. You can find it in the App Store or go to mixel.cc and get a link to it. Our main focus is on growing the audience. We think this can be an audience or user base of tens, if not hundreds of millions of active, engaged users. With an audience that size, yes, like in-app purchases and other freemium things become really interesting possibilities. We also have some ideas about getting creative, working with brand advertisers too.
Yes.
But that stuff is... Those are all theories right now, and
artists. Have you reached out to like Banksy or someone, just as an example?
I'd love to chat with Banksy about this. We have reached out to some artists that we've been able to spend time with, from our personal networks, trying to do some grassroots evangelism that way now. As we grow, as we staff up,
what about selling? Like, I make a Mixel. And then, in the same way people can print photos from Flickr, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or make booklets from Flickr. What about, ultimately, like a gallery showing of like the best artists who emerge from Mixel, and competitions, sponsored competitions between competing Mixel artists. I think there are lots of potential ways to monetize it that don't suck at all. That would be cool and within the... within the brand feeling that's emerging, which is very open and fun and friendly and not commercial.
Yeah, I fully agree. Again, going back to the model of digital photography, there's a lot of ways to make money in digital photography now, and I think there will be a lot of ways to make money in digital art, and that's the groundwork that we're trying to lay right now. Whether it's, physical goods or virtual goods or, offline experiences, there's just a ton that can be done when you create a user base of people who are passionately creating stuff. I think that's really powerful.
Album art would be nice too.
Oh yeah, I'd love to get a band sort of crowdsourcing their covers and stuff like that. Here
we go. Fun. We're about out of time, and I could talk to you forever. I hope we'll be able to check in with you again in a year and see where Mixel is and what other amazing projects and things you're up to. For now, people can find you at subtraction.com.
Right.
Or on Twitter as Koi.
Yep, K-H-O-I.
K-H-O-I. You also have a website for your dog, I believe?
Yeah, that I haven't updated in forever. That was okay. More of a lark.
Okay.
When I had more free time, I was able to put that site up.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time and for all the things you do to make the web exciting.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey. This is a lot of fun, and congrats to you for this and for all the other stuff that – all the other awesome ways that you enrich the web.
Yay. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Take care.
Take care.